It is 24th of May, 1235, and Isabella of England is having a blast in Cologne. When they moved into the city, 10,000 people were on their feet. Depending on how you counted, there was every second or third inhabitant of the city. The warm welcome in the city on the Rhine had not quite blown away a homesickness, as if by magic, but it had given the 21-year-old English princess and soon-to-be Holy Roman Empress a change of heart, at least for the moment. Although it was still spring, this May 24th, 1235 was a sunny day, as Roger of Wendover, an English chronicler, recorded in his work Flores Historianum, who wrote down Isabella's visit to Cologne. This was later continued by his successor Matthew of Paris. You can probably guess why the English princess Isabella stayed so far away from her homeland. That's right, she was there to mend the strained relations between the Hohenstaufen dynasty and the English crown. Remember that the English crown was mostly in the opposing camp in a German throne dispute. On the side of the Welfs, Hohenstaufen and Emperor Frederick II, ruler of the Holy Roman Empire for almost 20 years now, wanted to put an end to it with the wedding. And so the English king Henry III gives his beloved sister Isabella to the Empire as a bride. Isabella probably missed her home. Who could blame her? She had known for some time that she would have to leave England. For a long time there had been talk of whether she should marry the French king or the emperor's son. Neither had materialized, and instead of the emperor's son, she now married the emperor himself. At 41, the emperor was almost twice as old as Isabella. But how had Isabella come to Cologne? Quite simply, Isabella could hardly have travelled from London to Cologne via the Eurotunnel within a few hours, as it is possible today. The journey was long, and so she was virtually picked up directly by important German princes. These included the Archbishop of Cologne, the well-known Heinrich of Müllenarg, and the Duke of Brabant. When she left England for good on May 11, Isabella was accompanied by an entire fleet to protect her, because rumor had it that the French king would be only too happy to abduct her if he had the chance to make her his bride after all. But as we know, this did not happen. Isabella arrived safe and sound in Cologne on May 24, 1235, to great rejoicing. Why is this so important for the history of Cologne? Well, first of all, a high-ranking visitor from England is of course something special. Isabella would stay in Cologne for around 6 weeks. It was not until July that she travelled on to Worms, where she would marry her future husband, Emperor Frederick II. No, what made Isabella of England's stay in Cologne so interesting was the way Cologne welcomed her, or rather the local inhabitants. We'll go into this in more detail in a moment. Just as a little preview, it shows a city whose inhabitants consider themselves to be quite self-confident. Let's take a look at the individual social groups in the city directly after the intro. And with that, welcome back to the History of Cologne, a podcast about the history of the city of Cologne that is over 2,000 years old, but until it became what it is today, this old city on the Rhine has endured a colorful and rich past, hence it can therefore be seen as a microcosm of European history. In this podcast, you can listen as the city grows from the Romans up until our present time. Just as a little reminder, after this episode, I'll be taking a little summer break, as I do every year. I enjoy a little more time for myself and my loved ones, and above all, recharge my batteries. That will also be good for this podcast as well. And don't worry, I'll be back on August 12th. Let's return to Cologne in May 1235, when Isabella is welcomed to the city with great honor and ceremony. It is really interesting to see how and who prepares to welcome the future empress. Of course, the Archbishop of Cologne, who had personally fetched Isabella from England, had certainly ordered his servants and his ministers to make the necessary preparations in the city. All those present were treated to a great spectacle right outside the city gates. Several magnificent wooden ships sailed towards them. colorful and elaborately decorated. It looked like they were really floating above the earth. Clergymen sat on board and played their instruments. The ships glided miraculously towards Isabella and her entourage as invisible waves were driving them along. Only those who looked closer could hear that, or see better said, that horses inside the ships were driving them. The horses were largely hidden to the side with precious silk blankets. But it is above all the citizens of Cologne inspire the English chroniclers who wrote about that event. Around 10,000 of them, half or a third of the city's population, marched to meet Isabella before she arrived in the city. They all dressed festively and adorned themselves with flowers to welcome the royal guest. But what really astonished visitors was the appearance of the city's richest citizens. They rode along on horseback on valuable Spanish horses, which were particularly coveted in the knighthood. In armor and the colors of their respective families, it was astonishing that rich citizens of Cologne, who were after all only commoners and not members of the nobility, would take part. Fake it till you make it was the order of the day, with success, because in fact several Cologne families were soon to achieve knighthood for real. And they not only dressed like knights, they also behaved like them. The English chroniclers report, quote, "Sitting on Spanish horses, they urged them to run fast while they broke both the lances and arrows they had in their hands," end quote. A real jousting tournament at the gates of Cologne. The city was in a great party mood on May 24, 1235. The city was decked out, street vendors offered food and drink, music and singing was everywhere. Let's take a look at the people in the city as far as we can, and let's start at the bottom and then work our way up to the rich citizens of the city. At the lower end of urban society were all those who had little or no property. Farmhands and maids, for example, or day laborers, but also impoverished widows, the seriously ill, people with disabilities, or impoverished orphans and widows. In addition to having few or hardly any possessions, there was another category that placed you at the bottom of society. These were professions or activities that diminished your honor. These included prostitutes, of course, or homeless people, and beggars, or an executioner who could live pretty well with that, what he was doing, and got a good amount of money and wealth, but he was at the low end of society after all. These people lived mostly in the outskirts of the city, often in illegally built dwellings, or even outside the city in one of the suburbs, and came back into the city every day and left it at night. What is important to mention, however, is that they are all at the bottom of society, yes, but they are not excluded or outside from society, as we sometimes, as a society, do today with people who, were not lucky in life, so to speak. According to the ideas of the time, every person was given their place in the world by God. You had to prove yourself in this role in order to get to heaven. Of course, this did not provide comfort for those affected, but it did give those in a better position the task of looking after those people. They certainly had their place in the circulation of goods and in the city's economy. Beggars were the ideal way for the better off to clear their conscience on a daily basis. Whoever donated to them was one step closer to a place in heaven. There were not only beggars in front of the churches, but also poor people who had previously collected moss and brushwood in the surrounding areas of Cologne. Moss, for example, could be used in many ways. Was there a drought somewhere on a window or a wall? Just stuff some moss there. Bed too uncomfortable? Use some moss as padding. I guess you guys know that already if you watch survival shows on the internet. The same applied to brushwood, whether as kindling for fires, for building a house or fence, or to make a broom, versatile indeed in use. And if someone from the lower classes managed to acquire some wealth through donations, welfare or a charitable gift from a benefactor, the person was always entitled to buy property. This was possible, although it certainly didn't happen very often. Wealthy citizens donated monasteries or hospitals to care for the sick, orphans, or the poor. Remember an example that I mentioned here in passing. The White Women's Convent, founded by rich citizens in 1226, was set up specifically to turn prostitutes into good and pious servants of God. However, the plan did not really work out after around 20 years. Only righteous women from the upper class and middle class were still living there. The fact that prostitutes also had their place in society was evident in certain cases. The so-called beautiful women were at the lower end, but there are cases where clients were convicted by the courts if they mistreated the beautiful women or inflicted violence on them. Whether there was always persecution in such cases, let alone whether it was always reported, is of course another matter. Let's move on to the middle class. We also briefly touched on the medieval middle class in this podcast. The economic boom of Cologne's richer citizens as long-distance traders and bankers also benefited many other people who were in contact with them. But it was above all the merchants and craftsmen, the line was often blurred here, who achieved a certain prosperity. A family of craftsmen slash traders usually owned or leased a house, which they could call their own. Houses were not cheap back then, as it is nowadays, but they weren't as expensive as you would think back then. Back then, there were no excessive bureaucratic requirements, nobody built fiber optics, underfloor heating, or water and electricity pipes into their homes. A house made of wood and half timbering was built very quickly, provided you had the financial means to do so. The first floor, or the front part of the house, was the sales area and also the workplace. As I said, craftsmanship and trade went hand in hand in Cologne. If you were a carpenter, you also sold your goods directly to the end customer at the market or in your workshop, and on the second floor you lived with your family. Some were even able to buy another house with their savings, which they then rented out. Pretty similar to nowadays, isn't it? Who belonged to the middle class in Cologne? Of course, this was not always necessarily due to the profession itself, but also how successful you were in it. But we can certainly make a few cautious generalizations. Firstly, they are the bakers. These were divided into two groups in medieval Cologne. Those who baked bread for ordinary people, the so-called panifices in Latin, and then there were those who baked exclusively for the clergy, in other words, for everyone in the monasteries and convents. These were called pistores in Latin. The bakers for the monasteries in particular were able to make a fortune from their select and often wealthy clientele. From the shrine books already known to us, we learn that some bakers had a tax burden that came close to that of a wealthy upper-class citizen, because they had so much property and wealth. One obvious profession, however, that of butchers, did not seem to be as economically successful. The weavers were particularly dominant in the textile industry and were also to become very powerful and vocal in the future of Cologne's history. We know of doctors working in Cologne as early as Roman times. This is proven by Roman gravestones that have been found. Of course, there were also doctors in the Middle Ages in Cologne. A doctor was called a physicus back then. There were also doctors who belonged to the clergy. Our famous Archbishop Engelbert, however, employed a doctor called Wilhelm, who was not a member of the clergy. So we had doctors who belonged to the clergy and doctors who did not. Otherwise, there are the numerous trades, all of which could be counted as middle class. Not very wealthy now, but not desperately poor either. All the metal workers we have already covered here in an earlier episode, or all those who work with leather or small traders, for example. The ministerials can fall into both the middle and upper class. We have often spoken about them, about their rise as former unfree servants of the archbishop to sometimes powerful administrators and rich citizens of the city and the surrounding area. The archbishop could not be everywhere in person. He therefore recruited influential and wealthy citizens from his domain on the Rhine and, of course, in Cologne itself, and involved them in his rule. A modern civil service, as we know it today, did not exist for a long time. Ministerials acted as soldiers, administrators, advisors, witnesses, creditors, or held offices such as bailiffs, secular administrators. They served as treasurers, as financial administrators, as tax collectors, or mint masters who supervised the minting of coins in Cologne. As we've talked about ministerials many times before, I'd like to keep this brief. However, I would like to point out the irony of the ministerials once again. The ministerials, who were once unfree and bound to the archbishop, were the key to the political emancipation of the citizens of Cologne, and they did so peacefully and with the consent of the city ruler, the archbishop of Cologne, for a long time under the archbishop's radar. Now in the 13th century, when the archbishops realized that this was increasingly threatening the archbishop's rule of the city, it was already too late. From then on, the archbishop and the citizens had to come to an understanding regarding the rule of the city, with all its ups and downs, as we know. Poverty is not sustainable. That was a quote from a historian whose name I unfortunately can't remember. What does that mean, poverty is not sustainable? Well, only those who have possessions can pass them on. Only those who have possessions, physical objects literally, which, as I said, are either inherited or even go into the ground to be rediscovered by archaeologists centuries later, are remembered. Or those who can afford to be immortalized in a document. Like someone who buys a new house and ends up as an entry in a shrine book, for example. I hope you understand what I mean. The sources on the small but extremely rich and powerful upper class of Cologne's inhabitants, are much better preserved as those of the poor and the normal people, so to speak. So, a dilemma that we always face as historians. Who was the upper class in Cologne? Or rather, who was at the very top? In the 12th century, it was mostly a crew of ministerials and merchants, about 60 families. Whereby family did not only mean father, mother and children back then, the familia had a male leader who, in addition to his own family consisting of sons and daughters and his wife, also included brothers, sisters, cousins, aunts and uncles. The previous episode is a good example of this, where Dietrich von der Weise von der Mühlengasse and his two brothers were the leaders of their clan. In addition to the blood relatives, there were also the servants and maidservants, as well as the clients who were in debt to the respective family or were otherwise loyal. Those were also counted into a family back then. In the 13th century, however, a process of demarcation began to develop that would continue well into the second half of this century. The circle of families at the head of the city became smaller. Many smaller ones would fall out in the process. The remaining families would increasingly separate themselves from the rest of the city's population and see themselves as better than all the others. In the end, only 15 families would remain, or rather, not families, but Geschlechter, as they said in Cologne back then, as the patrician families of Cologne called themselves, the city nobility, so to speak. Unfortunately, I have not found a suitable translation for the German word Geschlecht. In particular, the family of the Weisen von der Mühlengasse, which was dealt with in the last episode, had amassed so much power around 1230, especially in the Collegiate of Magistrates, that the other families in the city were up in arms. I mean, it was not without reason that an attempt was made to expel the Weisen von der Mühlengasse from the city in 1237. Around 1235, the von der Mühlengasse family had risen so quickly and become so powerful that the other wealthy families in the town were afraid. Some joined forces under the leadership of another family, which was called the Overstolzen family. We have already briefly touched on the Overstolzen in the last episode at the very end, and before as well, I think. Just shortly. The Overstolzen had risen relatively late to become one of the richest families in the city. Long after Gerhard Umarzer had amassed his wealth and passed it on in the late 12th century, Gottschalk Overstolz appeared in historical sources around the year 1200, the founder of that family dynasty. As a simple owner of a cloth store, Gottschalk was given the derisive name Overstolz, meaning the haughty one, the too proud one. Gottschalk Overstolz died shortly afterwards, around 1205, but as modestly as Gottschalk himself had lived and saved all the money he could to make his family rich, he had cleverly married his 9 children into influential and above all wealthy Cologne families. At his death, he owned 16 houses outright. He owned shares in a further 9. There was hardly a corner in Cologne where he did not own a store that he rented out as a profit, whether on Heumarkt Square or anywhere else in the city. Even 9 grown-up children could be richly endowed with this inheritance. By around 1235, the Overstolzen were already represented by 2 family members in the Collegiate of Magistrates. This was the body in which the Weisen von der Mühlengasse dominated. The Overstolzen had also risen socially and politically in a short space of time. The von der Mühlengasse family, however, even more so. And so the irony was that the far too rapid rise of the von der Mühlengasse family ensured that the opposition to them would form around the Overstolzen family. Which is funny because the Overstolzen had achieved exactly the same, but later. The Overstolzen family became really rich around 1235. In the last episode, we met Blitildes Overstolz, who had built a large, magnificent house with her husband, Werner, in the Rheingasse alley, south of Heumarkt Square, which you can still look at today. It's hard to believe nowadays when you stand in the Rheingasse alley, but where today the small street connects the banks of the Rhine with the old town, more like a mini expressway, back then it was a top address for Cologne's merchant class. Many of Cologne's later powerful families lived here. The Jude family, the Hardefust, or the Lüskirchens. They were all later allies of the Overstolzen as well, who were their neighbors. Cologne's upper class, the patricians, so to speak, had once all acquired wealth through trade and or through their service to the archbishop. Here in the first third of the 13th century, many of them had arrived and settled down, being the upper class. Many of the heads of Cologne's richest families no longer went on journeys themselves. They preferred to stay here, locally, and leave their children or servants to travel and trade in England or Italy, for example. As the chiefs of those families now mostly stayed at home, they also tried to realize themselves here. Patricians built large, magnificent houses like that of the Overstolzen family, or they simply bought up all the surrounding plots of land in the neighborhood, flattened the existing buildings, and built something nice and big with a garden and a courtyard. This was something that only the nobility in the countryside had ever built before that. And what is better than earning money actively as a trader? Right, earning money passively as bankers and investors. Cologne patrician families bought estates, sometimes even far away, in order to generate income. As bankers, they gave loans to high nobles and in return had them confer knighthood on them, for example, even though they were actually only the third class and not nobles after all. But even without an official knighthood, the wealthy citizens started to act like this, as the spectacle of Isabella's of England's visit in 1235 showed us. Nowadays, we know traders are peace-loving and, above all, number-loving people. Anyone who traded long distance in those days, though, had to have it, had to be tough. Not only in negotiations and as a trader on a market square, no, away from it too, whether by land or sea. You have to remember, transporting valuable goods over long distances often aroused curiosity, so to speak. Quite simply, for thieves especially. That could be anyone. Anybody could be a thief, not only the classical pirates. As you know, opportunity makes thieves. That is a metaphor in German. I have no idea if that's a metaphor in English as well. But quite simply, sometimes it was easier for a trader to rob another fellow trader. Imagine you had a larger ship that had just sailed into the North Sea. You just started a few weeks or days ago, and a larger crew you also had on your ship. And then you see coming up a smaller ship that was sailing towards you, that has been already to England, and comes across the open sea, and it is full of goods and crates and barrels with fancy stuff in it. And, well, you wonder whether you should really just continue the long journey to England and sell your stuff or buy your stuff. Or maybe, why not take a shortcut after all, attack the little ship, kill everyone, take the cargo and sail home. Maybe that's a more effective way to get to business. So yes, as a trader, you also had to be battle-hardened to survive and be familiar with weapons. You could not just call the police on the open sea back then, because there was none. I think that every truck driver necessarily, even today, has his own safety measures when he or she goes to sleep in the cab at night at a rest stop or next to a highway. Cologne's merchant class, once described by Lampard of Hersfeld in the 11th century as a weakened, snobby population weakened by the pleasures of life in the city, that's not really true, because those long-distance traders certainly knew how to fight. They showed that in 1074, and it wouldn't be long before that became apparent as well in the 13th century. I don't need to tell you twice that Cologne's citizens and its elite were highly respected as well. Meanwhile, the citizens' ruling class was sometimes able to conclude deeds directly with popes and emperors now, without having to take the actual route via the city or the Archbishop of Cologne. The Archbishop also liked to make use of his noble citizens and used them as witnesses in his official business, especially when he drew up deeds or documents. It is often only thanks to the latter circumstance, in addition to the shrine books in the wards, that we knew about Cologne's wealthy elite so early on. We must not forget, and I in particular sometimes tend to forget, yes, there were often conflicts between the citizenry and the Archbishop, wrangling over powers, rights, duties and freedoms, or taxes even. But it was a system that had stood the test of time, with a few brief temporary exceptions such as 1074, when there was a rebellion against Archbishop Anno. For the rest of the time, however, and we are talking about several centuries past in the 13th century, the system between rich citizens and the Archbishop had worked as far as the administration of the city was concerned. The Brotherhood of the Rich, the Richardzeche, and the original Archbishop-controlled Collegiate of Magistrates worked closely together. However, of course, disputes remained, as we know all too well. It was this mixture of conflicts and cooperation that would characterize the 13th century and the relationship between the citizens and the Archbishop. We will soon find out, because never before has been the cooperation so strong between those two parties, and the conflicts so strong as well between those two parties. Last but not least, we have to talk about a high class in Cologne as well, the clergy, the Cologne clergy. Even if the church, especially in the late Middle Ages, was presented as a completely separate class, here too there were great differences. You could become a powerful, wealthy bishop or the provost of a monastery with a large income, but you could also be a poor priest with no income and no chance of promotion. Spiritual institutions and their members represented an enormous economic factor in the city. In addition to their spiritual purpose, they were also a tightly organized economic enterprise of their time, with properties of various kinds in the city but also often beyond. Entire monasteries owned a variety of property, collected rents, and were even lords over farmers and the inhabitants of the town or a specific part of the town. Of course, we must not forget the Jewish community, but this is a topic that I would like to take up in a future episode, when a certain Archbishop of Cologne were to decide something on this subject in the middle of the 13th century. Last but not least, I would like to talk briefly about the nobility, the real high nobility. For a long time, the nobility, like dukes or counts, avoided Cologne during the Middle Ages, the early Middle Ages and parts of the High Middle Ages. Frankish nobles, for example, in the early Middle Ages, preferred to live far away from cities in their castles and country estates in general. Even Charles the Great, or Charlemagne, usually only passed through Cologne. Longer stays in the city are not known, although Charlemagne, in his will, named Cologne as the, quote, most elegant bride of Christ after Rome, end quote. But Charlemagne had already been dead for over 400 years now in the middle of the 13th century. In other words, as long dead as King James of England, Scotland, and Ireland, who died in 1624, would be today. In the meantime, people of high nobility were happy to settle in Cologne. Cologne's monasteries and convents in particular are full of high nobility from the Rhenish aristocracy or even international nobility. This was particularly true of the male monastery of St. Geryon and the three female monasteries of St. Ursula, St. Cecilia, and St. Mary in the capital, only high nobility people living there as nuns or monks or canons or canonesses. Other monasteries, which also admitted non-noble members, always had a high-ranking provost or a high-ranking abbot, at least at the top of the monastery leadership. The most important monastery, the Cathedral Monastery, had almost exclusively members of the high nobility in its ranks. And let's not forget that the archbishops themselves were descendants of noble families from the Rhineland. Remember the episode about the dynasty of Berg? Their family members sat in numerous monasteries and thus significantly determined the course of the Cologne Church and therefore the city of Cologne. The same applied to the dynasties of Jülich, Limburg, and Geldern. Even those high nobles who did not become clergymen liked to visit the city. To be in the center of power on the Rhine, the archbishop, or of course to have fun in the largest city of the empire and to present or represent themselves. Many bought permanent estates and houses in the city in order to be able to stay in the city at all times and have a base. The dynasty of Berg, the Limburg dynasty, etc., they all had their house in the city. Do you remember still Gerhard Unmazer from an earlier episode? The rich man from Cologne at the end of the 12th century? He died without male descendants and his heiress went to a convent with her daughters. His property, including his magnificent residence directly opposite the archbishop's palace with the best view of the old cathedral, was therefore sold, and the buyer was none other than Duke Henry of Brabant, the very duke who brought Princess Isabella to Cologne together with the archbishop in 1235. Unfortunately, he, the Duke of Brabant, was unable to witness the lavish celebrations that were offered to Isabella, because he fell seriously ill on his return journey and died that same year in Cologne in the very house that had once belonged to Gerhard Unmazer. So you see, it was quite a colorful bunch that lived here in medieval Cologne back then. Rich and poor, noble and non-noble, clergy and laymen, archbishops and dukes lived here, often close together or at least as direct neighbors. They all made up the population of high medieval Cologne. However, we often lack the necessary historical sources for the majority of the city's inhabitants, those from the lower and middle classes, so that our narrative and our view is often narrowly focused on the upper class, a dilemma that we can hardly escape as historians, with all due respect. I think that's enough for today, and I can now send you off into my summer break. I'm going to use my vacation and the month's absence to see how best to continue here, because so much will soon be happening in parallel: Cologne's economic progress, the disputes with the archbishop, and, oh yes, by the way, just the start of the construction of today's Cologne Cathedral is also taking place at the same time in the middle of the 13th century. Oh dear. Thanks this time to Antje, Christian, Sabine, Nicole, Silvia, Claudia, Elisabeth and Robert for your tips via PayPal, and thanks to Suresh David for your now long-term support via Patreon.com. Remember, I'll be back like every year after my summer break. Don't forget me, recommend me further to others, and Auf Wiedersehen.